Don't preach about King. Preach King. This is the advice that one of my colleagues recently posted to social media. She was responding to a tendency on this annual holiday of Martin Luther King Jr. weekend to preach a sermon that recounts the steps that King took on his journey to civil rights. The sermons often culminate in the victorious "I Have a Dream" speech, with generous excerpts from that familiar talk. Now, about a year ago, I preached a sermon about the film Annihilation. Its director, Alex Garland, was interviewed around the time of its release. The interviewer asked him why people always want something new and different when they go to the movies, and whether his current film was original. What he said was really intriguing to me. He said that most of the time that Americans go to the movies, they are not looking for something different. Instead, they are expecting to see the same things. The same old story told just a little bit differently. He went so far as to say that these stories are repeated like rituals, reenactments that solidify our view of the world rather than challenge it. The retelling of King's story has often fallen into that same rut, I fear. It has become a national sacred holiday in which we retell and reenact a familiar story. We make laudatory statements and sometimes reflect that there is more work to be done, and then we usually go about our lives unchanged until the next anniversary rolls around and we remember again. The prophetic fire of King's legacy is barely concealed beneath the surface of his words, however. What is ironic is that so many of his writings, sermons, and addresses rarely give ritualistic comfort. I would contend that they have a hard edge that cuts into the edifice of power and privilege today, no less than they did in the time that they were written. But those writings are often ignored, and other more familiar parts can be rehearsed in their place. As Clinton Lee Scott provocatively puts it, sometimes the grandchildren of the people who stoned the prophet gather up those stones to build a monument. Sometimes our culture can do that with King's legacy, I think. Now, part of the reason that King's legacy may seem less relevant is because it has been deracinated. The roots of his thinking have been forgotten, and when they are remembered, they are often distorted. Sometimes he's quoted to endorse harmless virtues or promote programs for charity work because his writings have been cherry-picked. But King drew from a distinct stream of American theology and social ethics. Remembering some of those pieces of King's writings and the heritage that he was drawing from and what he was trying to accomplish with that heritage, I think sheds new light on his legacy and how it might challenge us today. King drew from the social gospel tradition specifically, which was only about 50 years old in King's time. Until about 1907, the dominant stream of Christianity did not consider itself a force to change social structures. Sometimes it could be used to critique people who were in power, or it could be used to promote charity. But it was not considered a mandate to change an entire social system. The gospel was thought to inspire personal generosity and kindness, but this did not necessarily translate into structural social transformation. So when Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor," people might have read that as a reminder to treat the poor well in their personal lives. But it was not seen as an indictment of a social system that caused poverty. One pastor, Walter Rauschenbusch, had been working in the New York neighborhood known as Hell's Kitchen. The son of German immigrants, he served a small German-speaking congregation in that town. There he saw the tremendous weight of the Gilded Age bearing down on the poor. As his great-grandson Paul Rauschenbusch, who is also a minister, put it, he was introduced in that time to overcrowded tenements with high rent, horrendous working conditions rewarded with intolerably low wages, lack of heat in winter, and lack of recreational facilities in the summer, all accompanied by consistent hunger and substandard health services. Walter Rauschenbusch served this congregation faithfully and struggled as best he could to meet the needs of his impoverished congregants. But eventually his hearing began to fail, and he feared that he could no longer serve them well. So he took a job as a professor in a seminary where his wife Pauline helped him with his hearing difficulties. And it was during that time that he began to have the idea for a book. He started writing it several times, only to give it up and move on to other projects. In his head, he started calling it The Dangerous Book, and he wasn't sure if it was something that he wanted to risk publishing. Nonetheless, in 1907, Christianity and the Social Crisis was released. Rauschenbusch then went on a six-month trip to Germany to continue his own studies and had no idea that that book had hit American churches like a brick. But it had. In less than a few years, it became the second best-selling religious book next to the Bible. Rauschenbusch returned to an American landscape that was being profoundly reshaped by his thought. Christianity and the Social Crisis reimagined how the church should think about the message of Jesus, the role of religion in society, and the problems of the social order. Its author said that Jesus had a unique mission to challenge systems of power that oppress and dominate people and to bring social institutions closer to justice. He writes, "Jesus bore within him the germs of a new social order. His redemption extends beyond individual souls to all human needs and powers and relations." In other words, the message of Jesus was not about personal salvation, but rather about changing the whole social order and bringing it closer to justice. Now, some of us may cringe a little bit when we hear this talk about Jesus reforming the social order. I know I do. It can sound a little bit like the Christianizing or baptizing of the state that is touted by some evangelicals today. But Rauschenbusch had a much more sophisticated understanding of the relationship between the religion and the state. He was a staunch advocate for the separation of the church and state because he believed that when the church became too politically enmeshed, it lost its prophetic fire. In ages past, the church had become a handmaiden to the state, and anything that was prophetic or humane or revolutionary was thereby lost. Thus, he wanted a church that was separated from the state so that it could be free to throw rocks into the gears of injustice and actively work to establish a more humane social order. When he spells out exactly what this would look like, a dramatic revolutionary vision begins to take shape. He highlights the problems of poverty, of no minimum wage, of child labor, of overcrowding and lack of sanitation. He insists that these things cannot be fixed with charity work. Such an unjust distribution of wealth creates crises that no church organization can address through acts of service. Instead of focusing on charity work, he says, Rauschenbusch urges congregations to partner to effect change of social conscience, of legislation, and of economic priorities at the state and national level. Here he echoes the parable of the Good Samaritan, saying, "It is not enough to attend to the person assaulted on the side of the road. One must also stop the assaulters." Now, Walter Rauschenbusch despised the apocalyptic sentiments of his day, which frequently emphasized being quiet about social injustice while waiting for the kingdom to come. But he had his own version of apocalypticism in his writings. He predicted doom for a country that ignored the social teachings of Jesus. "Nations do not die by wealth," he writes, "but by injustice. Progress slackens when a single class appropriates the social results of common labor, fortifies its evil rights by unjust laws, throttles the masses by political centralization and suppression, and consumes in luxury what has been taken in covetousness." With fiery rhetoric such as this, Rauschenbusch sounded the alarm on religions that had fallen asleep to injustice. So what is the legacy of the social gospel of Walter Rauschenbusch? In the book Christianity and the Social Crisis in the 21st Century, theologians came together to assess this question. James Forbes says that the book inspired a generation of progressives and planted the seeds of the New Deal. Others note the contribution that it made to the future civil rights movement. As Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "In the early 1950s, I read Walter Rauschenbusch's Christianity and the Social Crisis, and it was a book that left an indelible mark on my writing, thinking, and work." King was able to brilliantly appropriate Rauschenbusch, who unfortunately said very little about race, and he was able to bring Rauschenbusch to bear on that most profound movement of social justice that brought forth the civil rights movement. Rauschenbusch's legacy has profoundly reshaped American religion and culture in innumerable ways. There is a problem here, however. I would say that the towering stature of King and the diffusion of Rauschenbusch's ideas have, in some ways, produced a superficial familiarity with their work, which undercuts the challenge to power and oppression that is inherent in their message. The church and the wider culture has created a version of King and of the social gospel with which they have become too comfortable, creating a familiarity that can allow for compartmentalization and an anticipation that prevents us from hearing the disturbing radicalism that first inflamed the movements for social justice that grew out of those writings and work. Today, we can become quite comfortable hearing that Jesus had a message of social justice, or that religion should insist on socially humane policies, or that the civil rights movement was valuable and good and important, and then not necessarily do anything about it. This is because the language has become ritualized, and it lulls us to sleep with repetition rather than spurring us on to action. Perhaps this is why we often find the words of King plastered on posters in grade schools, touting benign virtues of character such as honesty Or we see a Martin Luther King Day of service where people are expected to do charity work, but we don't necessarily see a Martin Luther King Day of justice where people are expected to change society. One thing that I think is for certain is that King himself would have been more comfortable on the streets protesting the injustice that we see today than he would be on any poster in a classroom or as a spokesman for a day of charity work. Drawing from the tradition of the social gospel, he would have been the first to push against the ever-widening gap of wealth that has only gotten worse since the 2009 recession, because he had already talked about that, saying, God never intended for one group of people to live in superfluous, inordinate wealth while others die in abject, deadening poverty. He would have railed against a health care system that continues to leave so many behind and whose reforms did not do nearly enough, for King had already foreseen that, saying, of all of the forms of inequality, injustice in health care is the most shocking and inhuman because it often results in physical death. And he would have been the first on the streets to protest the injustice perpetuated against people of color, and especially African Americans, like the 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was shot by police, because King was familiar with that kind of brutality, the brutality of guns and hoses and dogs. We have all seen those images. And he would have written and spoken about the injustice of the richest country on earth, talking about money for a border wall when so many of the people who are arriving at that border are fleeing persecution and hardship in their own countries. We know that because he had already spoken in front of the Berlin Wall with these prophetic words: here on either side of this wall are God's children, and no man-made barrier can obliterate that fact. Whether it be east or west, north or south, men and women search for meaning and hope and fulfillment and yearn for faith in something beyond themselves, and they cry desperately for love and community to support them in this pilgrim journey, regardless of their race, their creed, their ideology, or nationality, because we are bound together by an inescapable destiny. We must find the common humanity which makes us sensitive to the suffering of others, or we will perish as a nation. It is no mistake to do charity work to honor Dr. King, but it is a mistake to become too comfortable with his words, his legacy, his challenge to power. If we are to rehearse his legacy, let's not remember only the easy parts, but also his articulation of a social gospel whose roots are deep, but whose work is just beginning. That work is too important. There is too much left undone, too much pain and suffering. Should we choose to remain silent about that, about all of those things that matter, I believe that such a loss will be so profound that the very stones will cry out. My spiritual companions, amen. I love you, and happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day.